From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We generously ask big media to sit on Santa's knee, tell us what it wants for Christmas, and then push through whatever of those wishes are politically and practically feasible. No test to see if anyone's been naughty or nice. Just another big shiny present for the favorite few who already own an FCC license, and a lump of coal for the rest of us.
As the Federal Communications Commission paves the way for further media consolidation, we'll hear from dissenting FCC Commissioner Michael Copps on why he voted against rewriting the nation's media ownership laws. Then, shooting back, an Israeli human rights group gives Palestinians video cameras to document life under occupation. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Turkish warplanes bombed Kurdish areas in northern Iraq earlier today in the fourth cross-border Turkish raid in 5 days. Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Turkey's fight against Kurdish rebels will go on despite protests from Iraq's government.
Our determination will continue as planned. It is impossible for us to make concessions because fighting against terrorism is our priority now. Therefore, it is a necessity for us to keep fighting against terrorism as the parliamentary permit entails.
The Turkish military claims it destroyed more than 200 Kurdish rebel targets and killed hundreds of Kurdish fighters in a series of airstrikes 10 days ago. The governments of Poland and Australia have announced plans to withdraw combat troops from Iraq within a year. During a surprise visit to Iraq, newly elected Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd said Australia's 550 combat troops will head home by June. Meanwhile, Poland plans to withdraw its 900 troops by October. Defense Secretary Robert Gates said 7,500 more U.S. troops are needed in Afghanistan to counter increasing violence by the Taliban. The United States already has 26,000 troops in Afghanistan. Gates said al-Qaeda has regrouped on the Pakistan border area.
There is no question that some of the areas in the frontier area have become areas where al-Qaeda has reestablished itself. But so far, we haven't seen any significant consequence of that in Afghanistan itself.
California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has announced plans to sue the Environmental Protection Agency for denying the request by 17 states to impose their own standards for limiting greenhouse gas emissions from automobiles. Schwarzenegger said the EPA had blocked the, quote, will of millions of people in California and 16 other states who want us to take tough action against global warming. Meanwhile, the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform has launched an investigation into the EPA's decision. Committee Chair Henry Waxman accused EPA Administrator Stephen Johnson and the Bush administration of ignoring scientific evidence in favor of allies in the automobile industry. The EPA announced its decision less than 2 months after Vice President Dick Cheney and White House staff members held a series of meetings with executives from the auto industry, including the CEOs of Ford and Chrysler. During the meetings, auto executives made clear they are concerned about California's proposal for stricter emissions standards. The Lakota Sioux Indians have withdrawn from all treaties with the United States and declared their independence. A delegation from the tribe delivered the news to the State Department last week. Longtime Indian rights activist Russell Means said, quote, "We are no longer citizens of the United States of America, and all those who live in the five-state area that encompasses our country are free to join us," he said. Lakota country comprises portions of Nebraska, South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming. The Lakota said the decision was necessary in the face of what they described as colonial apartheid conditions. The life expectancy for Lakota men is less than 44 years. 97% of the Lakota people live below the poverty line. The Lakota also said the United States never honored many treaties signed dating back to the mid-19th century. The Washington Post reports the FBI is embarking on a $1 billion effort to build the world's largest computer database of people's physical characteristics, including digital images of faces, fingerprints, palm patterns, iris patterns, and other biometric information. The project will give the government unprecedented abilities to identify individuals in the United States and abroad. The FBI will also retain, upon request by employers, the fingerprints of workers who've undergone criminal background checks so the employers can be notified if employees have brushes with the law. The plan is drawing criticism from those who worry that people's bodies will become de facto national identification cards. Barry Steinhardt of the American Civil Liberties Union said, quote, it's going to be an essential component of tracking. It's enabling the always-on surveillance society. Palestinian leaders are urging Israel to halt plans to build 740 new homes next year on occupied land near Jerusalem. Palestinian Prime Minister Salim Fayyad said Israel's plans to expand the settlements is sabotaging negotiation efforts.
Pursuing peace on the one hand and pursuit of a policy based on continued settlement expansion are two parallel paths that will never meet. They cannot meet by definition. There's a basic fundamental contradiction here. Settlement expansion has to stop if peace process is to have any credibility. This is what has been agreed, what was agreed at Annapolis. We expect for there to be a complete cessation of these activities.
Meanwhile, in the West Bank, Palestinian demonstrators scuffled with Israeli soldiers on Friday during a demonstration against the Israeli separation wall on the West Bank. Protest organizer Sami Talhamis was one of several activists dressed like Santa.
Bethlehem, from where Jesus was born, from where the apartheid wall is being built around our villages and cities, we say, yes, there is hope. There is hope for peace, and there is a chance for peace. It needs the world to move. It needs the world to realize that there is injustice happening here, and for the world to say, we will work for peace in the Holy Land.
In other news from the region, an Israeli military prosecutor has concluded Israel's use of cluster bombs during the 2006 Lebanon War was justified and does not violate any standards of international law. Lebanese officials accuse the Israeli army of covering up war crimes. The United Nations and Human Rights Group says Israel dropped about 4 million cluster bomblets during the 34-day war. More than 30 people have been killed by cluster bomb and landmine explosions in Lebanon since the 2006 summer war. In news from India, the nationalist Hindu politician Narendra Modi has been re-elected head of the western state of Gujarat. Modi has been accused of sanctioning the massacre of 2,500 Muslims in Gujarat in 2002. A recent expose in the Indian magazine Tehelka revealed that Modi gave Hindu right-wing activists 3 days to attack Muslims with impunity. In other news from Asia, the government in Nepal has agreed to abolish the monarchy as part of a deal with Maoist rebels. Maoist chief Prachandra said, quote, for the first time in Nepal's history, a republic will be written in the constitution. This is not an ordinary achievement, he said. The decision to abolish the monarchy will become effective after next year's elections for a constituent assembly. And a newly declassified document from 1950 shows that former FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover drafted a plan to suspend habeas corpus and imprison some 12,000 Americans he suspected of disloyalty. Hoover sent his plan to the White House in July 1950. 12 days after the Korean War began, Hoover wanted the FBI to be able to permanently detain all individuals potentially dangerous to national security and jail them at military bases and in federal prisons. According to the New York Times, no known evidence suggests President Truman or any other president approved any part of Hoover's proposal. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Federal Communications Commission last week voted 3-2 on party lines to approve a measure that would increase media consolidation. The new rule, pushed through by FCC Chair Kevin Martin, lifts a 30-year-old ban on companies seeking to own both a newspaper and television or radio station in the same city. But the reaction against the vote has been swift. Close to 200,000 people have signed an open letter urging Congress to overturn the December 18th vote. Less than 24 hours after the vote, Democratic Congressmember Jay Inslee and Republican Congressmember Dave Reichert introduced the Media Ownership Act of 2007 that would overturn the new rules by the FCC. It was Bush-appointed FCC Chair Kevin Martin, now just 41 years old, who rammed through the rule changes. He served President Bush well. As Deputy General Counsel for the Bush-Cheney campaign in 2000, he was active during the Florida recount. Before that, he worked for Kenneth Starr at the Office of Independent Counsel during the Monica Lewinsky scandal. Rumor has it he may run for governor of his native North Carolina. His wife, Kathy Martin, was a spokeswoman for the Vice President Dick Cheney in the midst of the scandal around the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. She now works on Bush's communications staff. Today, we'll play the speech of one of the two dissident FCC commissioners, Michael Copps. Copps has been fighting media consolidation since he was appointed to the FCC in 2001. He's a former history professor. He called the vote a Christmas gift to corporations.
I had an opportunity to read a little bit of George Orwell the other day, and it was good preparation for getting ready to deal with this particular item. I think it would do him proud. We claim to be giving the news industry a shot in the arm, but the real effect is going to be to reduce total news gathering. We shed big crocodile tears for the financial plight of newspapers, yet the truth is that newspaper profits are about double the S&P 500 average. We pat ourselves on the back for holding six field hearings across the United States, yet today's decision cites not a single word from the thousands of Americans who waited in long lines for an open mic to testify before us. We say we have closed loopholes, yet we are introducing new ones. We say we're guided by public comment, yet the majority's decision is overwhelmingly opposed by the public, as demonstrated in our record and in public opinion surveys. We claim the mantle of scientific research, even as the experts say we've asked the wrong questions, used the wrong data, and reached the wrong conclusions. I am not the only one disturbed by this illogical scenario. Congress and the American people have done everything but march down here to storm Southwest D.C. and physically shake some sense into us. Everywhere we go, the questions are the same. Why are we rushing to encourage more media merger frenzy when we haven't demonstrated the when we haven't addressed the demonstrated harms caused by previous media merger frenzy? Women and minorities own low single-digit percentages of America's broadcast outlets, and big consolidated media continues to slam the door in their faces. It's going to take some major policy changes and a coordinated strategy to fix that. Don't look for that from this commission. Instead, we are told to be content with baby steps to help women and minorities, but the fine print shows that the real beneficiaries will be small businesses owned by white men. So even as it becomes abundantly clear that the real cause of the disenfranchisement of women and minorities is media consolidation, we give the green light to a new round of, yes, you guessed it, media consolidation. Local news, local music, and local groups so often get shunted aside when big media comes to town. Commissioner Adelstein and I have heard the plaintive voices of thousands of citizens all across this land of ours, in dozens of town meetings and public forums, from newscasters fired by chain owners with corporate headquarters thousands of miles away, to local musicians and artists denied airtime because of big media's homogenization of our music and our culture, from minorities reeling from the way big media ignores their issues and caricatures them as people, to women saying the only way to redress their grievances is to give them a shot to compete for use of the people's airwaves, from public interest advocates fighting valiantly for a return of localism and diversity, to small independent broadcasters who fight an uphill battle to preserve their independence. It will require tough rules of the road to redress our localism and diversity gaps, too. Do you see any rules like that being passed today? to the idea that license holders should give the American people high-quality programming in return for free use of the public airwaves, the majority answers that we need more study of problems that have been documented and studied to death for a decade and more. Today's outcome is the same old, same old. One more time, we're running the fast break for our big media friends in the four-corner stall for the public interest. It's time for the American people to understand the game that is being played here. Big media doesn't want to tell the full story, of course, but I have firsthand from editorial page editors who have told me they can cover any story, save one, media consolidation, and that they have been instructed to stay away from that one. That's a story for another day, perhaps. Today's story is a decision by the majority, unconnected to good policy and not even incidentally concerned with encouraging media to make our democracy stronger. We're not concerned with gathering valid data, conducting good research, or following the facts where they lead us. Our motivations are less Olympian and our methodology far simpler. We generously ask big media to sit on Santa's knee, tell us what it wants for Christmas, and then push through whatever of those wishes are politically and practically feasible. No test to see if anyone's been naughty or nice. Just another big shiny present for the favored few who already own an FCC license and a lump of coal for the rest of us. Happy holidays. If you need convincing of just how non-expertly this expert agency has been acting lately, you could not have a better example than the formulation of the cross-ownership rule that the majority will adopt today. I know it's a little detailed to see how the sausage is made, but it's worth a look. On November 2, 2007, with just a week's notice, the FCC announced that it would hold its final media ownership hearing in Seattle. Despite the minimal warning, 1,100 citizens turned out to give intelligent and impassioned testimony on how they believe the agency should write its media ownership rules. Little did they know that the fix was already in and that the now infamous New York Times op-ed was in the works, announcing a highly detailed cross-ownership proposal. Put bluntly, those commissioners and staff who flew out to Seattle, 16 witnesses, the governor, the state attorney general, and all the other public officials who came, plus the 1,100 Seattle residents who had chosen to spend their Friday night waiting in line to testify, were, as Representative Jay Inslee put it, treated like chumps. Their comments were not going to be part of the agency's formulation of a draft rule. It was just for show, to claim that the public had been given a chance to participate. The agency has treated the public like children, allowed to visit the cockpit in an airliner. You know, when you go up there with your little kid, they're not actually allowed to fly the plane, but they're permitted for a brief, false moment to imagine that they are. The New York Times op-ed appeared on November 13th, the next business day after the Seattle meeting. The same day, a unilateral public notice was issued, providing just 28 days for people to comment on a specific proposal, with no opportunity for replies. The agency received over 300 comments from scholars, concerned citizens, public interest advocates, and industry associations, the overwhelming majority of which condemned the plan. But little did these commenters know that on November 28th, 2 weeks before their comments were even due, the draft order on newspaper broadcast cross-ownership had already been circulated. Once again, public commenters were treated as unwitting and unwilling participants in a kabuki theater. Then last night at 9:44 p.m., just a little more than 12 hours before the vote was scheduled to be held and long after the sunshine period had begun, a significantly revised version of the order was circulated. Among other changes, the item now granted all sorts of permanent new waivers and provided a significantly altered new justification for the 20 market limit. But the revised draft mysteriously deleted the existing discussion of the four factors to be considered by the FCC this morning in examining whether a proposed combination was in the public interest, and in its place, the new draft simply contained the cryptic words, revised discussion to come. That's what we got last night at 9:44. And although my colleagues and I were not apprised of the revisions, USA Today fared better because it apparently got an interview that enabled it to present the chairman's latest thinking. Maybe we really are the Federal Newspaper Commission. Finally, at 1:57 this morning, we received a new version of the proposed test for allowing more newspaper broadcast combinations. I cannot claim that I fully appreciate the test's finer points, given the lateness of the hour, and the fact that there was no time afforded to parse the finer points of the new rule. But this much is clear, the new version keeps the old loopholes and includes two new ones. Finally, as I walked out of the office at 11:15 this morning, we received a revised paragraph on the details of the four factors. And forgive me if I am unable to speak expertly about what they mean to the substance of this decision. This is not the way to do rational, fact-based, and public interest-minded policymaking. It's actually a great illustration of why administrative agencies are required to operate under the constraints of administrative process and the problems that occur when they ignore that duty. At the end of the day, process matters. Public comment matters. Taking the time to do things right matters. A rule reached through a slipshod process and capped by a mad rush to the finish line will, purely on the merits, simply not pass the red face test. Not with Congress, not with the courts, not with the American people. It's worth stepping back for a moment from all the detail here to look at the fundamental rationale behind today's terrible decision. Newspapers need all the help they can get, we are told. A merger with a broadcast station in the same city will give them access to a revenue stream that will let them better fulfill their news-gathering mission. At the same time, we're also assured our rules will require independent news judgment, at least among consolidators outside the top 20 markets. In other words, we can have our cake and eat it too, the economic benefits of consolidation without the reduction of voices that one would ordinarily expect when two entities combine. But how on earth can this be? To begin with, to the extent that the two merged entities are truly independent, then there won't be the cost savings that were supposed to justify the merger in the first place. On the other hand, if independence merely means maintaining two organizational charts for the same newsroom, then we won't have any more reporters on the ground keeping an eye on government. Either way, we can't have our cake and eat it too.
Federal Communications Commissioner Michael Copps speaking just before the vote to axe the ban on newspaper broadcast cross-ownership. We'll come back to his speech in a minute. Something Coming by the late jazz pianist Oscar Peterson. He died on Sunday at the age of 82. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we return to the speech of the dissident Federal Communications Commissioner Michael Copps, speaking on December 18th, right before the vote to axe the ownership rules, the ownership ban between newspaper and a radio television in a town took place. Copps said the FCC's decision to ease the restrictions on media consolidation would negatively impact both minority and female ownership and also undermine serious coverage of local politics.
In the final analysis, the real winners today are businesses that are, in many cases, quite healthy. And the real losers are going to be all of us who depend on the news media to learn what's happening in our communities and keeping an eye on local government. Despite all the talk you may hear today about the threat to newspapers from the internet and new technologies, today's order actually deals with something quite old-fashioned. Powerful companies are using political muscle to sneak through rule changes that let them profit at the expense of the public interest. They are seeking to improve their economic prospects by capturing a larger percentage of the news business in communities across the United States. Let's get beyond the weeds of corporate jockeying and inking up our rubber stamps for a new round of media consolidation. to look for a moment at what we're not doing today. That's the real story, I think, that the important issues of minority and female ownership and broadcast localism and how they are being shortchanged by today's rush to judgment. First, on minority and female ownership. Racial and ethnic minorities make up 33% of America's population. They own a scant 3% of all full-power commercial television stations, and that number is plummeting. Free Press recently released a study showing that during just the past year, the number of minority-owned full-power commercial TV stations declined by 8.5%, and the number of African-American-owned stations, get this, decreased by nearly 60%. It's almost inconceivable that this shameful state of affairs could be getting worse. Yet here we are. In most places, there is something approaching unanimity that this has to change. Broadcasters and citizens and members of Congress and every leading civil rights organization agree that the status quo is not acceptable. Each of my colleagues has recognized, I think, that paltry levels of minority and female ownership are a reality, which makes today's decision all the more disappointing. There was a real opportunity here to do something meaningful today after years of neglect, and we blew it. Didn't have to be this way. I proposed both a process and a solution. We should have started by getting an accurate account of minority and female ownership. That's the one that the Congressional Research Service and the Government Accountability Office both just found that we do not have at the FCC. The fact that we don't even know how many minority and female owners there are is indicative of how low this issue is on the FCC's list of priorities. We also should have convened an independent panel, like proposed by Commissioner Adelstein and endorsed by many, that would have reviewed all of the proposals before us, prioritized them, and made recommendations for implementation. We could have completed this process in 90 days or less, and then would have been ready to act. Today's item ignores the pleas of the minority community to adopt a definition of eligible entity that could actually help their plight. Instead, the majority directs their policies at general small businesses, a decision that groups like Rainbow Push and the National Association of Black-Owned Broadcasters assert will do little or nothing for minority owners. Similarly, MMTC and the diversity and competition supporters conclude that they would rather have no package at all than one that includes this definition. Lack of a viable definition poisons the headwaters. So should we wonder why the fish are dying downstream? So while I can certainly support the few positive changes in this item that do not depend on the definitional issue, such as the adoption of a clear non-discrimination rule, these are overshadowed by the truly wasted opportunity to give potential minority and female owners a seat at the table they have been waiting for and have deserved for so very long. My fear now is that with cross-ownership done, the attentions of this commission will turn elsewhere. On localism, at the same time that we have shamefully ignored the need to encourage media ownership by women and minorities, we have witnessed a dramatic deterioration of the public interest performance of many of our licensees. We have witnessed the number of State House and City Hall reporters declining decade after decade, despite an explosion in state and local lobbying. The number of channels have indeed multiplied, but there is far less local programming and reporting being produced. Are you interested in hearing about local politics from the evening news? About 8% of such broadcasts contain any local political coverage at all, including races for the House of Representatives. And that was during the 30 days before the last presidential election. Interested in how TV reinforces stereotypes? Consider that the local news is four times more likely to show a mugshot during a crime story if the suspect is black rather than white. The loss of localism impacts our music and entertainment, too. Just this morning, I had an email from a musician who took a trip of several hundred miles and heard the same songs played on the car radio everywhere he traveled. Local artists, independent creative artists, and small businesses are paying a frightful price in lost opportunity. Big consolidated media dampens local and regional creativity, and that begins, my friends, to mess around pretty seriously with the genius that is America. It's a travesty. We allow the nation's broadcasters to use $500 billion of the people's spectrum for free. In return, we require that they serve the public interest, devoting at least some airtime for worthy programs that inform viewers, support local arts and culture, and educate our children. In other words, that aspire to something beyond just minimizing costs and maximizing revenue. Once upon a time, the FCC actually enforced this bargain by requiring a thorough review of a licensee's performance every 3 years before renewing the license. But during decades of market absolutism, we pared that down to postcard renewal, a rubber stamp every 8 years with no substantive review. So to begin with, the FCC needs to reinvigorate the license renewal process. We need to look at a station's record every 3 or 4 years. I'm disappointed that the majority has so cavalierly dismissed this idea. And we should be actually looking at the record. Did the station show original programs on local civic affairs? Did it broadcast political meetings? In an era where too many owners live thousands of miles away from the communities that they allegedly serve, do these owners meet regularly with local leaders and the public to receive feedback? Why don't we make sure that's done before we vote to allow more media consolidation? In 2004, the Commission opened up a notice of inquiry to consider ways to improve localism by better enforcing the quid pro quo between the nation's broadcasters and the public. The notice addressed many of the questions raised by earlier dormant proceedings dating from years before. Today's localism notice asks more questions and tees up some very meritorious ideas. But again, my question, why the rush to vote more consolidation now, consolidation that has been the bane of localism, and why put off systematic actions to redress the harms consolidation has inflicted? Our FCC card is ahead of our horse. Before allowing big media to get even bigger and to start the predictable cycle of layoffs and downsizing that is the inevitable result of, indeed, the economic rationale for many types of mergers, we should be enforcing clear obligations for each and every FCC licensee. Those who look for substantive action on these important issues concerning localism and minorities will look in vain. Once the majority works its way on cross-ownership, I'm not optimistic about prospects for future action on these fronts. We're told that we cannot deal with localism and minority ownership because that would require delay. But these questions have been before the Commission for a decade, and they have been ignored year after year. These issues could have been, should have been, teed up 10 years ago. We begged for that in 2003 when we sailed off on the calamitous rules proposed by Chairman Powell and pushed through in another mad rush to judgment. Don't tell me it can't be done. It should have been done years ago, and we had the chance again this time around. Now, because of a situation not of Commissioner Adelstein's or my making, we are accused of delaying just because we want to make things better before the majority makes them worse. When I think about where the FCC has been and where it is today, two final conclusions. First, the consolidation we have seen so far and the decision to treat broadcasting as just another business has not produced a media system that does a better job of serving most Americans. Quite the opposite is true. Rather than reviving the news business, it has led to less localism, less diversity of opinion, less serious political coverage, fewer jobs for journalists, and the list goes on. Second, I think we have learned that the purest form of commercialism and high-quality news make very uneasy bedfellows. As my own hero Franklin Delano Roosevelt put it in a letter to Joseph Pulitzer, quote, I have always been firmly persuaded that our newspapers cannot be edited in the interests of the general public from the counting room, end quote. And I think that applies to broadcast journalism, too. This is not to say that good journalism is incompatible with making a profit. I believe that both interests can be balanced. I believe both interests must be balanced. But when TV and radio stations are no longer required by law to serve their local communities and are owned by huge national corporations dedicated to cutting costs through economies of scale, It should come as no surprise that, in essence, viewers and listeners have become the products that broadcasters sell to advertisers. That's you and me I'm talking about. We could have been, should have been here today lauding the best efforts of government to reverse these trends and to promote a media environment that actually strengthens American democracy rather than weakens it. Instead, we are marking not just a lost opportunity, but the allowance of new rules that head media democracy in exactly the wrong direction. I take great comfort from the conclusion of another critic of the current media system, Walter Cronkite, who said, quote, "America is a powerful and prosperous nation. We certainly should insist upon, and we can afford to sustain, a media system of which we can be proud," end quote. So now it's up to the rest of us. The situation isn't going to repair itself. Big media is not going to repair it. This commission is apparently not going to repair it. But the people and their elected representatives and attentive courts can repair it. Last time the commission went down this road, the majority heard and felt the outrage of millions of citizens and Congress and then the court. Today's decision is just as dismissive of good process as that earlier one, just as unconcerned with what people have said, just as heedless of the advice of our oversight committees and many other members of Congress, and just as stubborn, perhaps more stubborn, because this time it knows or should know what's coming. Last time, a lot of insiders were surprised by the country's reaction. This time, they should be forewarned. I hope, I really hope, that today's majority decision will be consigned to the fate it deserves, and that one day in the not-too-distant future, we can look back upon it as an aberration from which we eventually recovered. We have had a dangerous, decades-long flirtation with media consolidation. I would welcome a little romance with the public interest for a change. Thank you.
Michael Copps, dissident Federal Communications Commissioner, speaking just before the vote to axe the ban on newspaper broadcast cross-ownership that took place on December 18th. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. When we come back, an Israeli human rights group launches a project called Shooting Back, giving video cameras to Palestinians. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting over 650 stations around the country on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations on public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman as we turn now to a second round of Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, which were stymied on Monday after Israel refused to halt its settlement activity. At the U.S.-sponsored peace conference in Annapolis last month, Israel agreed to end settlement expansion. But the Israeli Construction Ministry unveiled a proposal Sunday to build 740 new homes on occupied Palestinian land near East Jerusalem. The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem has given Palestinian families across the West Bank video cameras to document how they're treated by Israeli soldiers and settlers. The project's called Shooting Back. Some of the videos depicting abuse by settlers sparked a national debate in Israel earlier this year after they were broadcast on Israeli television. Oren Yakovovich coordinates B'Tselem's video department. He recently traveled to the United States, joined me here in the Firehouse studio. I began by asking him to explain the project, Shooting Back.
Shooting Back, it's basically giving a Palestinian that living in high-risk areas that's probably going to suffer from human rights violation by the Israeli army and by settlers, we give them cameras so they can film their life. And basically, we can see the violation when it's occurred.
How did you come to do this?
All right. B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights, is documenting violation since 89. And the aim is to bring to the Israeli public and to the public in the world and decision makers violation. And the aim is, of course, to advocate for the end of violation. I would not be here speaking about violation, but it's happening all the time. So for many years, what we did reports. We're still doing them, and it's a long-term report. We're investigating the situation in the field. We have field researchers in every big city in the West Bank that taking testimonies, written testimonies, and we did some films about the reports that we were taking out. But there was kind of frustration that I felt all the time, and we felt in B'Tselem, because we know from written testimony that a lot of things are happening, and we don't really manage to see them. And it's becoming harder, more and more during the years to bring really new information or new visuals to the media and to grab public attention. And we look for a different point of view, a new point of view. And this is how we decided to start giving cameras to these people that are living in these places.
Where do you get the cameras?
Where we get them from?
You buy them and then give them
to... Yeah,
too.
We buy them.
Uh-huh. And so do you have support of people in Israel?
We have support of people in Israel, also in the world. Like B'Tselem is an NGO, and we've been found by a contribution. So we raise money and we buy the cameras and give them.
What does B'Tselem actually mean, the Hebrew word?
Okay, B'Tselem is coming from the Bible. And the first sentence in Genesis is God create man in his shape. In his shape.
In his image.
In image, yeah. So in his image, the Israel, the Hebrew word for it would be B'Tselem. So that's where it's coming from. Even though we are not a religious organization at all. But the aim is, of course, to point that everyone is being created in the shape of God and everybody's equal.
Oren, describe this first video we're about to watch and listen
right.
to.
What you're about to see is basically the first video that we took out for the media. It's happening in Hebron. Just to understand, Hebron is the only Palestinian city where Jewish settlers living in the heart of the city. Usually the settlements will be outside of the major city, around, close by, but not inside. In Hebron, basically because Abraham, the father of all religions, is buried there. It's a very holy place to the Jews also. And there is a settlements in the heart of the city. The result of the settlements is a lot of restriction of movements that are being held on Palestinians. There are many streets that they cannot really walk. Palestinians cannot drive cars in these areas. And there is a lot of violation that's happening there from the settlers that are living there. They are very radical settlers, more radical even than the rest of the West Bank. And we know from many, from a lot of years of watching the place or getting testimonies, that a lot of violations is happening there. What you're going to see is a clip from a settlement called Tel Rumeda in Hebron. What we will see is a settler from this settlement, from Tel Rumeda, pushing Palestinians that basically are living in across the street, in the other side of the road, pushing her back to her home, calling her whore, cursing her very viciously. And all this time, you see the soldier standing next to the woman doing nothing, not interfering.
Tell us about the Palestinian family, in particular the woman, both the Palestinian woman and the Jewish settler woman.
Okay, so the Palestinian is part of Abu Aisha family that's living in the heart of Tel Rumeda. They've been there for years, a lot of years. In 84, if I'm not mistaken, or 83, I don't remember, the settlement started. The Jewish settlement started in Hebron. This street that was open all the time to the family and to the people to come to visit her was closed. And now this is the only Palestinian family that can walk the street, the people living in this house. And they have nowhere to the only way out from this house is through this road. So basically every time they're going out from the door, they're confronting the settlement, the settlers. And you will see this clip, and after you see more clips, because we're getting a lot of material from this family. They are being attacked on a regular basis. Every time they go out of the house, there's a good chance they're going to get stones from the children or from the people that are living across the street, from the settlers.
And tell me about this particular settler woman.
Don't want to say her name, but she's a radical settler, and she's living on the other side of the street. She's kind of representing the settlers' population that's living in Hebron. And I have to say that even for the Israeli audience, she seems extreme, like she's very extreme, but what we know about her, this is the only, not the first time she's attacking, not her friends. There's attacks are happening there regularly on a regular basis. And what we see that the army and the police are not forcing the law, or there is a lack of enforcement there.
Let's watch. That video was filmed in Hebron. The Jewish settler woman, the Palestinian woman, was filmed by who, Oren?
The sister of the Palestinian being cursed is the one that's filming. Basically, there is a kid there, 16 years old, holding a camera while her sister being attacked by the settler. You see that the settler is coming to the camera, trying to push her into the house, and her sister just next to her, filming. And she's filming from, you see, I think you say barbed wire, or like, you know, net from
Through barbed wire,
yeah. Uh-huh. Because it's called the cage house, because they have so many trouble from the settlers, they have to build kind of a barbed wire around their house so they will not, to protect the windows from the stone, to protect them from the stone, and for all kind of things that they're throwing there.
Did this video appear on Israeli television?
Yeah, this video was, what was amazing, that I need to say about this video, that for the Palestinian, when they gave me the camera, they gave me the tape, they didn't talk about this video. Because for them it's casual. They didn't thought there's anything special in this video. While we watched it in the office in Bethlehem, we said, like, there's something very strong here that we need everybody to see. But for the Palestinians, they didn't say anything about this video. And then we put it out in one of the Israeli internet news channels. And very fast, there was a lot of hundreds of talkbacks and hundreds of clips on this video. Of course, hour after, I got already phones from the rest of the networks in Israel, news networks. Day after, it was everywhere in Israel.
It caused a major... So it first appeared on the web, then the networks took it.
Yeah. And... We were amazed what a debate it made in Israel. And the thing is, you have to understand, our problem is B'Tselem is not the settlers. The settlers are violence. Our problem is the policy, the lack of law enforcement, that the soldiers are standing there and doing nothing, that the police are there close by and doing nothing. And this is the major problem. And this is what was the debate about. Because people in Israel, or the audience, or the majority in Israel, they will not back up, or maybe they do, I'm not sure, but the settler is quite radical for their point of view also. The major debate was about the soldiers standing there and doing nothing. So day after, it was in all the news channels in Israel, been talked again and again, a lot of articles was written about it in the newspaper. After a while, the prime minister related to it, the defense minister related to it.
You mean Ehud Olmert had to address it,
speak
about it?
Yeah, Ehud Olmert said he saw it and he felt ashamed. That's what he said. And the moment, of course, they addressed it, then the rest of the networks all around the world wanted this clip, so because it became a huge issue. And then CNN took it, ABC took it, it was in Europe in all kinds of channels, Brazil, Japan, so it was widely watched. And what was amazing, this 1 minute that Palestinian women filmed, citizen or non-professional filmmaker, just made 1 minute that... basically changed the situation.
How old was the girl who filmed it?
16.
She's 16, and where is she now?
Still there?
Still in the house, yeah, still in the house. I have to say that the reality didn't change drastically. It did reduce some of the violations that happening in Hebron. That's what we heard also from the family itself. We know that the presence of the cameras there is reducing the violence because people know that they're being
and
filmed.
And the settler woman?
She's still there. She's still there. I think, if I'm not mistaken, she was supposed to come to a hearing last week in the court about this case. Didn't appear. She's still there.
I want to go to the second video. We're talking to Oren Yakubovich. He directs the video department of B'Tselem, the Israel Information Center for Human Rights, giving video cameras to Palestinians. Describe this.
Yeah. The second video, what you see here, it's happening in a Jewish holiday called Purim. In this holiday, I don't know if you know, but people are allowed to drink. It's written that you're allowed to drink. In Hebron, also, the kids are drinking, and you see some drunk kids there. They are the sons of Baruch Marzel, is head of one of the radical movements in Israel. We see, in the beginning, we see the soldiers a little bit holding the kids, but they're running away. And they're getting into this same family house through the door and throwing stones again and cursing and saying that they're going to destroy them. And then a little bit after, you see the brother of the same kids also drunk, just kicking wildly the door.
And this is the door of the Palestinian home.
And again, soldiers are there. They're walking on the streets. They're close by. Nobody's stopping them. Then you see him lying on the road next to the house and cursing and shouting till his father's coming to take him.
Let's watch. The settler boy says, "I will exterminate you," and throws a stone at the Palestinian's home. "Go away," he yells. "Don't you dare film me," he says to the girl filming. That video was filmed by the same 16-year-old girl of the Abu Isha family who filmed the first clip that we saw. How much attention did this get of the Jewish settler son kicking in the door of the Palestinian?
This got attention also in the news, of course. It was not internationally attentioned, but it got a lot of coverage in the Israeli media. But I have to say that it's very hard to understand, very important to understand that this things happening not just to this family. It's happening all over Hebron. It's happening everywhere with the settlers in Hebron. The violation is there all the time. This you see in other cameras also. Just brought this one because this is how we started the project, but you see it all over.
Talk about this next clip we're about to see.
Okay, what you're going to see now is different clip because there are cameras in all kind of places, so you're getting different footage from all kind of places. What you see now is there is kind of routine that the Israeli army is doing when there is somebody that they notice. This was something that's called the wanted list. It's kind of a list that in the head of the list is the one that most wanted. It's considered a terrorist. And then after there is the whole list. Whenever there is information about somebody that is on this wanted list, this kind of operation that the army is doing it's quite regular. It's happening a lot in the West Bank. Then we'll come to this house, surround this house, and then we'll call to the people to come out. They're checking the people. If the one that they wanted is not out, they will start throwing stone grenades, shooting on the walls, and then in the end they will start destroying the house. And what we see here is the operation that happened in Qalqilia. And it's quite a routine operation.
Where is Qalqilia?
Qalqilia is in the West Bank, north of the West Bank, one of the big cities in the north of the West Bank. What we see there is quite a routine. The thing is that in this occasion, there were 12 houses of Palestinians being destroyed. And they walked them in the street with their underwear. Not just family, then people from this area that was living there. So we got these testimonies, and it's very hard to make the army or make the police start investigating when you have this testimonies written. But the moment you have a strong video, it's much more easy to make a case. So what you see in this video, you see the operation itself, you see bulldozer destroying the house, you see people with underwear walking down the street.
And this is Men, women, and children?
No, just men. Ah. Just men. No children and no women. Just men's, just men walking in the street. You see the soldiers. You see the dogs. They're sending a dog after the house was destroyed to look for the wanted one. You see basically the operation itself. And it's something that we got a lot of written testimonies about, but we never saw it happening. And here we have the point of view of the Palestinians. You can hear in the background his kids talking to him, asking him to be careful, they will not shoot him. So you see kind of a Palestinian life, or where he's filming for, you feel the life, and the visuals, you see the operation itself.
Again, that was filmed at Qalqilya, and Oren, who filmed it?
It's a Palestinian guy that lives in just across the street.
Just happened to have the camera there that day.
Yeah.
And what kind of reaction did this film get?
This film didn't get much reaction. This film was helping us to analyze the operation, was helping us to ask the army to start investigation. This is something that we do in B'Tselem quite regularly. We will target violation, we'll see a violation, we'll ask the army to investigate this violation. We'll try to get conclusion about what's happening there. So this didn't get a lot of media attention, but it helped us to work, and it's something that went to the army.
How is the army dealing with you, with B'Tselem, with, as you're saying, B'Tselem is a long-time, very well-respected human rights information center.
Yeah.
Yet even B'Tselem, you put out reports based on people's testimony, they don't respond very much, but now you have the video. So how is the army dealing?
First of all, they do respond to reports. This I have to say. Every time we're getting a report out, we're getting back a reaction from the army, a letter written, a reaction, and we publish it together with the report. It's very important to have this, to make sure that it's there, that we know how the army will respond to this report. The thing is that they're asking us to film now. The army and the police asking us to film. They're telling us, if you have things that happening, please bring us the video, because they need it. They need it because there's sometimes just gap between the commanders or the high-rank officers in the army that at least see themselves as people that will try to protect the law and what's happening in the field. So the video is helping them to see what's happening there. They will ask for the film to really to invest sometimes to see what's happening there.
Have any charges been brought based on the video footage?
We know the charges was in Hebron against this the woman that was attacking. This process is quite new. We started a year ago the pilot, and in the last months we're running this project all over the West Bank, and investigation is taking time usually. It's something that we don't know the effect still till the end, but we know it did helping to make investigation.
If the army is encouraging you to do this, why don't they just hand out video cameras to all Palestinians?
This is a very, very good question. I hope they will do. I hope they will give everyone cameras there, to the Palestinians, to the settlers, to the soldiers, and everything should be seen.
And the title of this project, why did you choose Shooting Back?
Because it's Shooting Back. It's first of all kind of a weapon that the Palestinians have against human rights violation. Of course, everybody prefer that people will have cameras and not guns. So it's and they're shooting back.
And what ultimately do you hope to achieve?
First of all, I have to say that we're spreading more and more cameras all over the West Bank. In every place when there is tension and we know violation occur, we're giving cameras. This is very important. And I know that it's protecting the Palestinians. There are places that we know when the Palestinians taking out the camera, the settlers will run away, will escape, happening a lot in south of the West Bank. It's giving power. This word is called empowerment. I don't like this word so much, but I will use it. It's the children and the kids are filming. And it's helping to mobilize communities in Hebron where the community was destroyed. Suddenly they're filming, they have some kind of an interest, and they see in the videos talking about it. And what I hope to achieve is that everything is going to be filmed. At least there's going to be a feeling that everything is being filmed. Nothing is being done in the dark. And this is what B'Tselem was basically established for, to bring light to places that are in the dark so violation will not occur.
Oren Yakovlevich is with the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, which has given Palestinian families across the West Bank video cameras. The project is called Shooting Back. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can go to our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Hope to Caduce, Aaron Mate, Anjali Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Ricardo Lobo, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Peter Curries, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.